Welcome to the ClassCast podcast, where philosophy, policy, pedagogy, and people come together in honest, purposeful conversations about improving school and education for our students and our communities. I'm your host, Ryan Tibbins, an award-winning English teacher, speaker, tutor, and podcast host in Northern Virginia. You can listen and subscribe to the ClassCast podcast on all major streaming services, on YouTube, and at classcastpodcast.com. Ladies and gentlemen, class is in session. Welcome to the ClassCast podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Tibbins. Today, we're going to be speaking with Grant Schaefer, the Supervisor of Community Connections for Loudoun County Public Schools. I recently met Grant at the dinner, the banquet for the Loudoun County 40 Under 40 Awards, which I was honored with a couple of years ago. And probably far more importantly, my wife won this year. And so I had the good luck to go back and got to meet Grant and hear about some of the amazing work that he's doing, not just through the schools, but sort of connecting the schools to the community. And I thought this is exactly what we're trying to do on the ClassCast podcast, is have these discussions about how we can sort of improve the function of schools, maybe by redefining parts of what we're already doing. And so Grant very graciously agreed to speak with me to make time in his very busy schedule. So Grant, thank you for taking the time to talk. How are you doing today?
I am doing well. Thank you, Ryan, for having me. And yeah, the thanks goes both ways. I mean, you've got a lot of great people for your podcast and previous episodes and some good ones coming forward. So thanks for taking the time to include me in on this.
Yeah, no. And like I said, the work that you're doing, I think is both really important and interesting. And then, you know, just for those listening, you know, who don't get to see the documents, Grant sent his CV, a couple of days ago, just to make sure I had some background, which I appreciate. You know, I usually ask for a little bit, and that was great. But you've done all kinds of stuff leading into your current role, right? And so you really, I want to say like jack of all trades, but I'm not even sure that really encompasses, like, you know, you have a range here in sort of social work and working in the community, but you've done a lot of different things. So before we get into any sort of the big questions of the podcast, could you tell us a little bit about what you're doing currently as the community connection supervisor? Like, what does that mean and what are you doing now?
Yeah, well, that is a good place to start, because I feel like it does encompass a lot of the skills I've picked up by doing some different things in my career. And the irony of the title in some ways, right? So it's, on one hand, it's like, it attracts people. People are interested, like community connections. Well, what are you connecting? Who are you connecting? And then, but at the same time, it's a little vague, as you know, because in the school system, and in Loudoun in general, people use the word community often. So to have the actual title really is something that came about through the Department of Instruction. And so that's where I try to make my connection, is that I'm connecting experiences in the community and businesses and partners, you know, could be nonprofits, educational foundations, other people, to instructional experiences for students. So that's really the connection. And I, and again, I'm glad you asked, because it helps to really define that a little bit more, because it is kind of vague. Because I've done some community connecting in other ways throughout my career. And there's definitely ways that people do connect with the schools in ways that are not necessarily related to instruction, that are equally as important. And I'm definitely a fan and try to promote those. But mine is a little bit more in the instruction realm and relating to the profile of a graduate, sort of what we're, you know, characteristics we're wanting LCPS students to leave with. And also really trying to add to authentic experiences for student learning. So a lot of times looking at, you know, what's the product of what students are learning or working on or collaborating on, and then how can those relate to the real world? And a lot of this may sound familiar to you and other maybe LCPS people who have been around a while and know that sort of the foundation for community connections and where it really came about had a lot to do with Dr. Eric Williams's philosophy on connecting to, you know, he brought in kind of this One to the World piece that that you and others are probably familiar with. And part of that is this community connection piece of how do you connect what you're learning in the classroom to the outside world and relating to his mantra of contributors to the world and wanting students to really do that. So that's a that's kind of a broad view, but I try to be a little specific there too. But you know, I can definitely expand a little bit more on that as well.
No, it's great. And that actually you led right into what my follow-up question was going to be about project-based learning and what locally had been branded as One to the World, which I think maybe came out of the Buck Institute, or we're not the only place that's ever used that language, but we're certainly, you know, we certainly, grasped onto it, you know, pretty firmly for a little while. I think what's interesting is that with the general concept of project-based learning and students learning through inquiry and collaboration and all that, there's a lot of good to be done there. I also think that part of the reason that it took a little while to get these things rolling, and maybe we're still working on it, was a little bit of the rollout, right? You know, we had a new superintendent who we'd had, you know, Dr. Hattrick, the previous superintendent, had been superintendent for what, like 30 years or something, you know. He oversaw this going from a small rural school system to a fairly large suburb exurb. And then you have this massive change and the new guy comes in and he has this thing. And I almost feel like it wasn't a problem with the idea, but almost like the branding and the presentation were a little tricky. And especially at the upper grade levels, like where I'm at, you know, I teach high school and I teach almost entirely 11th and 12th grade. And I think that the way it was presented maybe slowed down the process a little bit. But, you know, over the last couple of years, for a variety of reasons, some of the project-based stuff has taken off. And I think it's starting to feel more natural to the teachers. And I think hopefully that's a good thing. But in order to do it well, you do need to be able to connect outside of the classroom. And right. This is something that I always say that I think it's a legitimate problem that we need to be serious about, is that most teachers are teachers because they liked school. They were pretty good at it for the most part. They then went to college and then they went right back to school as a teacher. You know, I mean, you have the career switchers, but most teachers have essentially never left school. So when they say, like, let's provide students this authentic experience, to the teacher, the most authentic thing is just doing school the regular way. I'm going to stand up front. I'm going to teach you some stuff. You practice, then we check it. And like, that is authentic to most of us, because that's what we've done. And so if you don't have real industry experience, then your quote unquote authentic work is really just faking it, unless you have someone else who can come in and back you up, which is maybe where the community connections become really important. You know, I see something my students could do. I see that there's a place for this in the community or in the workforce, but maybe I don't have that personal experience. So we got to find somebody. Yeah. How much do you work in that capacity and trying to help those connections? Because like I said, without those real connections, you know, the project-based learning isn't that much more authentic than what we were doing before. Is that part of what you're doing, is making the connections for the teachers?
Well said, because I think, you know, you touched on a few points there. One is sort of looking back at that rollout of, you know, to jump back a little bit to what you're saying, the rollout of One to the World, right? And again, I wasn't in the role that I am in now back then. And so I don't have too much of a critique of that, but it's more of like, it to me, what you said touches on the fact that, okay, are we meeting teachers where they really are, versus what you're saying about go to school, go to college, you want to teach, and then you get back into teaching and you go right into the classroom. So where, you know, you're missing maybe that component, right? So the other piece is part of that rollout, and maybe the one to the world approach is one that I try to focus on is that the teacher resource piece. So I am trying to build up essentially a large Rolodex of contacts and connections within the community, so that a variety of content areas can reach out and have a connection to authentic learning. So I think maybe in the past, when people in the business community and the community in general have thought about authentic learning, they've only thought of certain content areas. And, you know, maybe they haven't thought of English, for example, right? Let's use that. But maybe they've only thought of career and technical education, other courses like that. So what I'm trying to do, again, really, is to not only give a variety of connections and resources to the community. And that's why I've tried to use my connections with the nonprofit world and the educational foundation world to broaden some of those people who can come into classrooms. And so, so there's that. And then there's also, I always try to keep in mind, what is the experience of the teacher, meaning current experience. And I know I'm preaching to the choir because I'm talking to you, but you've got so much on your plate as a teacher. One thing that I want to try to alleviate is that push or that pull, or maybe that expectation that you've, as a teacher, on top of everything else that you're doing, you've got to go out and scrounge for these resources. So what I'm trying to do is to bring this network in so that it's easy and it's accessible to teachers, and that you can find who you want, because that's part of where I'm going is some of this dialogue with teachers to be able to tell me what's working and what's not. You know, where do I need to find more people, and what content areas, and who else might I reach out to? So the interesting thing that I found is that because in some ways this is a relatively new field, so to speak, that I'm working in Loudoun, let's put it that way, that many of the teachers and schools have done an awesome job of finding partners already. So how can I not get in the way of them, but yet add them to kind of a collective bank to help educate the new teacher, right? Who's coming in, who's also being told in some ways, hey, you need to make connections in the community, but they're trying to figure a whole lot of stuff out. So how can I be a resource to them? So it's a multi-pronged approach, really. And that's the exciting part of it, is that not only can I use some of my skills, but I'm continuing to learn from teachers and veterans as well. And you know, your principal that you run into who's been a principal for 25 years, who is more steeped in the community than I am, who's been here longer than me. So I think there's a lot of room to grow, and there's things I can bring, and then there's a lot of room to grow in this area as well, which makes it exciting and also ever evolving.
You know, there's a lot of good to be had regardless of how the connection is used, almost like, you know, whether it's the person's physically in the classroom, or, you know, you zoom call them in, or mm-hmm. even if that's just a point of reference where the teacher can talk to someone to get some perspective or to get some ideas. Even if that person, say from the nonprofit or business, doesn't physically appear in the room, still having the resource of a person in the local community who has been, you know, vetted somewhat, you know, we say, okay, hey, this is someone we can, you know, we can talk to and use. That is a valuable resource, you know, and it's not necessarily an easy thing to do. So, you know, for you, you know, I guess first, you know, congratulations on the 40 under 40, you know, that's awesome. But you're also in a position where an event like that, or, you know, sort of getting access to that kind of group of people could essentially be a real boost to you. You know, like I'm a classroom teacher. When I got, I was like, this is great. Cool. I love when people like tell me I did a good job. Thanks. You know, and aside from like talking to a couple people about like, hey, maybe appear on the podcast or something, like I didn't have any direct use for a lot of it. But for you, that networking element has direct application and value. So in addition to the pat on the back that is well-deserved, that also can maybe provide, you know, a couple additional opportunities and connections and things like that. When you think about, say, that award or that event or similar sort of functions, are those good places to find people who are interested in, say, supporting the school system? Or do you have more success with nonprofits, or like, you know, I don't want to say like, what's your target audience or whatever, but how do you make these connections? Like what's the best way to meet the people who end up helping to serve these classrooms?
Yeah, Ryan. I think, you know, you were definitely a good connection to make too, there at 40 under 40. And there's people like your wife and other people that, that I, if I didn't get to talk to them there, I've sort of looked them up on LinkedIn and other places like that to learn more. So definitely using that as a network. Yeah, I've used my experience in this program called Leadership Loudon. And Leadership Loudon is a signature program that's been around since the early 90s that takes different leaders from different parts of Loudon County, government, nonprofit sector, education, and brings them together and essentially gets them to, you know, to meet one another, but also puts them in some different activities and teamwork where they have to come up with, we had a project to do. And that was, we were pushed in a direction in an area that we may not know a lot about. So it's kind of sort of like a cross-cultural educational experience. And then from that, part of Leadership Loudon is networking within that as well and meeting other alumni. And so by going through that program 2019, 2020, and then being on the board of Leadership Loudon since then, that's been another great resource for me. So that's allowed me to meet some people in parts of Loudon County that I haven't worked in. It even kind of exposed me to some parts of Loudon County, literally, that I hadn't spent as much time in or knew very much about. Some of Western Loudon, for example, agritourism, those sort of businesses. So Leadership Loudon's been another group. The chamber has been very helpful, Loudon Chamber of Commerce as well. And then I would say dabbling a little bit with the Dulles Area Chamber of Commerce too. The School Business Partnership Council has been helpful too. I mean, it's literally a part of my job to work with them, but getting a chance to not only meet some of those council members, which again, kind of that same theme of people. So you've got business, nonprofit, and an educational foundation in there too, and the hospital system too. They've been helpful too. If not been, maybe people who work, in their businesses or their colleagues. And then lastly, I have to give a shout out to Loudon Economic Development. They are extremely dynamic group. There's some fascinating people that work for them, and they have been a champion of the schools and of me since I've come on my role, and my predecessors too. There were only two predecessors in the role, but they've definitely been a good contact there. So, so in general, those are sort of that's how I make connections. But again, it's still a learning curve, and some of it is just researching, reading, following up on everything from, leaving no stone unturned, so to speak. So whether it's a Loudon Now article that catches my attention that I'm like, wow, I didn't know this business was there, or voting for Small Businesses of the Year in the Loudon Chamber and really trying to focus on some entrepreneurs and say, wow, some of these entrepreneurs have some great skills that could really benefit students and teachers. So working with them, and some of them are a lot easier to get maybe than some other bigger name people, and they have a little bit more time and some flexibility. And then the virtual world has somewhat helped me to make it easier for people to jump on a call or jump on a Google Meet with a class than maybe be there physically present. So those are some ways that I've been trying to build up that Rolodex.
Yeah, that's awesome. And it's not easy to do because it takes so much time to like create each one of those. Like, you have to really sort of make sure that you have mm-hmm. the right people. And it's not for something like this where, you're not really offering like any kind of payment in return. Like, right. In most cases, the people who are going to help out or get involved are doing it out of their genuine interest in education or the goodness of their heart. Mm-hmm. that I'm sure there's some people who see some benefit in like letting young people or the teachers like know about their business or what they do. But in the end, that's going to really have probably for most people a limited impact. And so right. when you say like, I always think about in college, I had a job for a summer, probably a little more than a summer, where we did phone surveys. It was like telemarketing. But like, my first thing I'd say, I would break the script every time. You were never supposed to break the script. I'm like, listen, I'm not selling you anything. I promise. I just need you to answer some questions. They'd be like, huh? And I'm like, all right, listen, I'm going to roll through this thing. Just answer these questions. They're like, what do I get out of it? I'm like, the data goes back to your local government and helps them do the things you want them to do. And they're like, oh, that sounds good. You know, but I'd have to say that. And that was never part of the script, right? And you'd have to say, like, there's some way that this helps you or that you're helping the people around you. And when there isn't, you know, I'm not selling you anything, but I'm also not paying you. You know, sometimes it's hard to like grab the attention, you know, of someone who already has plenty to do. You know, and so while you're working in a public school system, and I know, you know, from peeking at your CV, like you have a background in social work and counseling. There's got to be some piece that's a little different, right? Because, you know, you really kind of have to press the flesh and network like a businessman, though you're not specifically running a business, you know? And so you're in sort of a weird hybrid role. Thinking about your, like, let's sort of pick up like your education. So I really want to ask like how you got here into this job. But given that some of your previous roles and previous jobs weren't this, you know, like what did you study in school? And then how did that somehow morph into the community connection supervisor?
Yeah. So, the background piece is interesting. I think you might be a JMU alum as well.
I am. Go Dukes. Right. I saw that. Yeah. I almost led with that. And I was like, I don't want to get too hokey about it here.
Yeah. So, JMU was a great start to my education in terms of, really understanding from early on in JMU and in studying social work, that the I forget the phrase that my advisor used, but it was something in regards of like the everything like policy. Yeah, policy impacts practice, and practice impacts policy. And so I think being in a sense educated in the field of social work with a policy sort of foundation and background, always, I think it ended up helping me later on in my career when I was getting into this sort of work when that wasn't necessarily on my radar to begin with. But I mean, what JMU also taught me was a lot about sort of community organizing in some ways, and finding out, you know, and through my social work education, doing needs assessments, learning about communities, the JMU Harrisonburg area was really fascinating, whether it was learning about the number of refugees that have lived and continue to live in the Harrisonburg area, or the independent study work I did with the African American community of Harrisonburg. I feel like that's where I start kind of cut my teeth, so to speak, with really being able to dive into communities and learning what they need, what they want, and then looking at the policy and the practice piece and saying, are the current institutions serving those and meeting those needs of those particular communities? And it kind of morphed into the social work realm of an LCPS, because I was advocating more for, you know, in student services, for what students particularly needed and what some parents needed as well, to really get through the educational system or to better benefit from our educational system. And so that experience and constantly needing help and to rely on the community, meaning mostly the nonprofit sector, right, to help many of the families I was working with, it instilled in me very much a teamwork approach to my work and to the success of different communities. And so no one was ever really going at it alone, and I could never, as a social worker, really take credit solely for one thing, because it was always a group effort. And so I think those connections made me want to go into the outreach services role to better connect with those community members, and I felt like they could be better utilized for the schools. And doing that for a little bit, and then jumping into, you know, the other realm of the business world. And that was a challenge for me and a push, but I think I was ready for that. And I tried to pride myself in constantly trying to put myself in new positions. So, you know, some of the nonprofit sector was familiar with me, and many of the names were familiar. And those same people have helped me in other ways and given me a little bit of credibility to go out and maybe meet some new business people and to further my Rolodex and my networks, which is, I think has helped in this role. So I think I still have some work to do and many people to meet in the business community, but I do feel like the social work background and perspective has helped a lot in not only the connections, but what you were speaking to, Ryan, in terms of the question that gets asked of, okay, well, what can you do for me? Right. And I think I've been answering those questions in other contexts. So that discussion isn't that really new for me. I have to be sometimes creative. And like you said, many times business people are wanting to help the goodness of their heart, or from their own perspective as a parent, or their child's experience with the school system, whether it went well or maybe in some cases didn't go that well. So they're interested in maybe some changes that way. But again, throwing in some of those listening skills and that kind of those people skills, that those stories come out. And so I am able to kind of to connect that way and maybe make connections that way. So it's been an interesting journey, but one that continues to be fascinating and one that keeps me challenged and growing. And Loudoun is a place where that I feel fortunate. It's allowed me to continue to do that. And there's more to experience and more to know.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, you know, you pointed to sort of starting in the social work role around Harrisonburg, which is where, you know, like I said, we both went to college, but you know, doing practicum and student teaching and stuff in the surrounding communities, whether it's in Rockingham County or neighboring counties. You know, I really, like, when I first decided this is where I'm going to school, had no idea the number of immigrants and the diversity of that. Like, I mean, from all over the world and people with legitimate refugee status, you know, and it's largely, you know, you don't normally think about it, but it's because of all the agricultural jobs that, you know, we need essentially unskilled labor. And this is a great place for people who want to work. But it also presents both, you know, interesting opportunities in terms of the people you meet and the work you get to do. It also presents some unique challenges. And what's interesting is you take that, say, that dynamic, and then you go to a place like Loudoun where, you know, on average, most of those economic difficulties are smaller. You know, we're not going to say no one struggles in the county. Plenty of people do. But I think that situation is a little more isolated than maybe, you know, it is in other parts of the state or things like that. But you have that background of making those connections in a diverse community with a lot of different things going on. And there's a lot of pressures pushing and pulling local governments there and here. So, I mean, it's a really sort of cool path to have been on. I'm not asking, you know, not asking when you're going to better deal us and bounce to make more money or anything, but you know, if you think about it, you know, you've been on an interesting career trajectory from sort of the more pure social work into different roles, into the community outreach, and now into this role. Like, where does this trajectory take you? Like, is this something that you think you can continue to grow in this role for a while? Or is there like a point where you sort of hit a ceiling, like where essentially, you know, not that I'm asking you to replace yourself or anything, but you know, like sometimes in a job like this, you need fresh blood just to keep the community interested. You got to have somebody new to talk to once in a while. What kind of growth is available in this kind of job? Trying to connect a large community to a large school system sounds like a massive, you know, monumental task, but I think you also, like, there comes a point where you say, okay, well, we've got most of the big fish. We have resources covering at least some of the more obvious demands or the things that teachers are asking for. You know, what else can you do? Like, is there a way to expand the role or expand the functions that you're providing in a classroom?
Yeah, I think there's plenty of room for for growth in this particular community connections office, right? So some of the things that I feel like we have a lot of room to grow in are is one area that actually we discussed when we first met was your experience that you talked about the furthering teacher education PD through a summer program you did through George Washington.
Right. Yeah. Just so everybody knows, it was called Teachers in Industry, and I don't think they do it anymore, but it was like a 6 or maybe 8 week externship where it was run by, I think, a professor there and someone who's like the liaison, half professor, half public schools. And they basically set us up with, it was a couple days of training. And then you spent like a week in a business, you know, in the community. And then you spent a day or two back debriefing, you know, back at the university. And then you went and did it like another week, I think, or week and a half. And then there was like a final presentation piece. But so I got to spend a week in Loudoun County government. And that was cool just because, or it was just several days. But every day, like every 2 hours, I was talking to someone else. I learned more. Like I'm now on the Berryville Planning Commission in the little town I live in.
Yeah,
I know more about zoning and stuff because of that, like couple days I spent hanging out with Loudoun County government than I would have learned anywhere else. Like I that's actually the only reason I feel even vaguely qualified for the role I fill in my town. But people did it all over. AOL, there was the agritourism stuff and all that. So when you mentioned, and I wanted to say that just because I really loved it. I thought it was a great experience. And so anyone who's listening, I sorry to interrupt you. I just want them to understand like what we're doing because it was a really cool program. And I never met anyone who did it who didn't have something positive to say about it afterwards. But you're saying like that's the kind of thing that you think you could capitalize on and sort of, you know, restart or grow. Is that part of it?
Yeah, definitely. And that's, I guess, you know, your experience there brings up is a good example of something that I want to restart and grow and then continue. Because I think what I've found that can be difficult in our county and other large counties is that sometimes you get things started that go well, and then they falter or they stop. And is it, you know, it could be a variety of factors, right? It could be new leadership. People change, you know, in both relationships, in both contexts. But those are things that, you know, the more I learn about some of those, the more I'm like, these have to be restarted and they have to be continued. And if I'm the conduit to that, if I'm the relationship to that, that's something that's going to keep pushing me to grow. Cause it kind of, like you were saying, I mean, we've got that. That's what I kind of like about the whole growth of Loudoun piece. Yes, we've grown a lot in even the time I've been here since 2007, but even before then we were growing, but the sort of the possibilities are endless with this role. Because another thing that I see is that, you know, I have a few models that I've been reading about and trying to see if, you know, long-term would we, you know, as we become larger, do we need to move into a, you know, I know people say this a lot. Do we need to move into a little bit more of a Fairfax County type model? And in terms of that, I've also been reading more about sort of some experiential education that's going on in Canada, some movement there. And so, you know, when I talk about, I'll talk about the Fairfax model, so to speak, but it's really, okay, when we look at partners, do we want to start tiering partners for schools? So do we have, you know, do I take let's just say a middle school, and do I begin working with them to help them tier their partners? Are their partners going to be, you know, instructional partners? Are they going to have a few that are working on resources for needy students and families? Are you going to have some monetary partners that are doing things like some landscaping work in the front, some beautification programs? So again, those are some examples of some ways that I can continue to grow and work within the school system. And that way better, you know, it's not about me and my Rolodex. It's more about building that capacity in the schools. And maybe then as we do continue to grow, maybe a person doing something similar to me is, you know, that role comes about in a school. Maybe it's, you know, the next step from the student activities and engagement coordinator role, that's new this year to the high schools. Maybe that's something down the road. The other piece that I find fascinating would be interesting to go into would be more, how do you work with a larger partner, a name that people know, you know, a Google, a Microsoft? How do you partner with them in a way that's not just about the name? It's not about just saying and being able to brag and say, yeah, I know someone from Google, or I partner with them. But it's how do we want them to sponsor a particular school or a program, or do we want them to, or do I match them up with our group of Title I elementary schools to provide programming for them, maybe also funding for some programming from after school programming, so that your you know, kind of looking at equitable resources for students, for places that have been historically been provided by a PTSO or a PTA. So those are some other, you know, things that I've thought of in terms of, you know, I'm getting started with some of that and working on my own kind of research with it, and getting people together and working on some alignment piece within central office. But those are some things that are baby steps right now, but I think are definitely areas of growth and things I'm interested in too. And so, you know, and lastly, I'll just touch on going back to that teacher piece. You know, how could I be a part of contributing to teacher professional development that's meaningful and that is something that teachers can look forward to and not be something else that they need to do in early August with with everything else on their checklist? Like how do you know that's something, you know, kind of a personal challenge that I've given myself, and that's another example of something that's definitely there's room to work with that.
Yeah, no, it's great. And I mean, the ideas of like the sponsorships and the more formal partnerships, yeah, it is interesting. And you're right. You can, by making those relationships a little bit more formal, a little more defined, you might be able to control some of the positive outcomes a little bit better, at least in some of it. But it also takes a lot more work, like organizationally speaking, yeah. Like, you know, to both create the sort of the framework for it and then to maintain those relationships. Whereas, you know, when it's a little more of an informal, like, hey, we need someone who blank, you make the phone call, they say, cool, I'll help out once, you know, and, yeah. You know, that's certainly an easier ask, but I don't know if that has the kind of large scale or long-term impact, like you said, you know, and so if you're doing sort of bang for your buck for the extra work that it takes, maybe that more formal arrangement could have some benefits. So a lot of this, you know, is revolving around the ideas of providing teachers and students access to these sort of authentic real world experiences, or to at least embed some of the learning in the community, or, you know, I don't know if anyone says it this way, but almost in reverse, to like embed the community back into the classroom, right? Like to bring the community into the room, just because logistically it's hard to send the kids out sometimes, especially when they're younger. And so that's important. But that also requires, at least for some people, sort of a reimagining of what schools do or can do. Mm-hmm. And so I want to ask you one of the, it's probably going to be two questions together, but a couple of the big questions I like to ask everybody on the podcast is, you know, what are we supposed to be doing? And then we'll follow that with sort of what do you think would be an ideal school? But just in terms of what schools already do, right? You pointed mm-hmm. to your start in social work and how your career sort of morphed into this community connections and this outreach role. You know, schools provide a massive amount of social work. And I mean, we now have, you know, we're increasing counseling and school psychologists mm-hmm. and I, it's hard to say any of that's bad, but I hesitate sometimes myself. And I, you know, when you hear people sort of, you know, rabble on about you know, defund police and whatever else. And I'm like, you know, I'm like, sometimes I'm like, maybe we could defund schools, like not actually just like it's sometimes it's hard to focus just on like the role of education, you know, and being an mm-hmm. educator when you know that in the building, we have like 150 other things we're also trying to do and provide for students.
Right.
That being said, schools are pretty well defined. We have the real estate and the staff and, you know, and we get a budget. And so it might be the easiest way to deliver some of these services to students, particularly the students who need the most. And so, you know, when we think about what a school's supposed to do, I think if we asked that question 150 years ago, we would probably get a very different answer than we get today, because our mission has gotten so much larger. From your perspective as a social worker and a community connector and trying to bring the community and the classroom together, what do you think is the purpose of school? Like, what should we be trying to do?
Yeah, that is a, I really like that question, and I spent some time on it. And a lot of it comes down for, to me, with kind of the purpose of school is something that I haven't really talked too much about so far is really that career readiness piece. And how I tie that back into is really it comes down to of making school applicable and making and really kind of, I guess, you know, I wrote, you know, one of the themes that I not theme, but a kind of a phrase that I use is helping students to find or seek their motivational treasure. What I mean by that is sort of like if part of school is helping students along the way to find some, what is that treasure that's going to motivate them? And the hope is then to motivate them to do something beyond school or after school with the skills that we're going to equip them with. And so that really speaks to, you know, things like finding not only a passion, but also something that I'm proud somewhat of what some schools have been able to do is really addressing complex problems in the complex world that we're living in. So begin to address and work on some issues that are hard, they're messy, but you know, part of what school I think should be doing is addressing those things that are messy, because life is messy. There's not a lot of, you know, one answer to this or one reason why something happens. So when you hear people say that school is not connected to the real world, I think we have to continue to look at that and really strive towards that and see how can we make it connected to the real world. And part of it there is again that career readiness piece. So that's a little bit of kind of where I come from and what I think school should be doing. And I think, and again, this is sort of my ideal, you know, world of Grant School, but that motivational treasure that hopefully we can find something that each student wants to learn about. I also was thinking about sort of this, the learn to learn component too, because we know that we only have a finite amount of time with our students. But if we can, if part of school can be to teach someone either that passion to want to learn more, or for some of our students, how to learn more. I think the want is there. They may not know exactly how do I learn more. And so again, I know that's kind of a vague and kind of ideal way to describe it, you know, describe the answer, but that's a little bit of where I'm at.
It's good. And this is actually something that's come up in several discussions on this podcast, not by, you know, direct intent. But there's this sort of divide between, say, a lot of people who are pushing for sort of the traditional, like liberal education, classical schools and that whole movement. Mm-hmm. And then there's this other side where people talk about sort of the career and technical skills and being career ready and all the rest. And myself, I think they're both important. I think what we've created is a false dichotomy. Like, I don't think it's an either or. I don't think you have to sit in the traditional school setting and read nothing but the classics and only do that sort of classical liberal education. I also don't think that for most students, a purely career focused education is ideal, just because maybe we're missing some of those pieces of like personal development, things like that. And to throw a quick example, a couple of years ago, I mentored a new teacher, and he's fantastic. You know, the fact that he was already good made me look good. Cause he really didn't need that much from me. Like, I'd like to think I was helpful, but he would have been fine anyway. But he was talking with his students about why they want, what are they trying to get out of his class? And they're like, oh, I want good grades. And he was like, okay, why? And they all, no one really knew. And then he was like, just throw, and they all threw out like, money or a job or whatever. And he goes, okay, so you want a grade in my class because it gets you money? And they're like, no. So he's like, that's it, let's do this. And so he diagrammed it on the board, and he like drew like a flow chart, and it was, I want an A in the class. And it was like, well, why? What does that lead to? It's like, I go to a good college. He's like, well, why a good college? You could have a great experience anywhere. And then all of a sudden it was, well, because the best schools will set me up for the best job. Why do you want that job? Because it pays me the most. Why do you need to make the most money? And they all threw out weird stuff. But the answer that the kids in that room latched onto was somebody who's like, so I can retire early. And he's like, so you want to get an A+ in sophomore English so that in 40 years, whatever, you can retire early and hang out and play golf? And they're like, yeah. And he's like, so everything you're going to do from now until then is just to say, and they're like, and like, as they were answering, he said, he's like, you could see it. Like, they were realizing that this was a stupid chain of events, and he said, so he created this sort of loose project. So when I actually did the countywide PBL project-based learning training, we sat in a team, and they're like, oh, you have to come up with this project, this unit you can do with these other teachers. And I was like, dude, let's do your thing. He's like, what? And I was like, that's it. Because in that process, when you get kids to figure out why they want to do what they want to do, that's that intrinsic motivation. Mm-hmm. These are the things I care about. But it also leads you into a place where it may not be that you have to be great in every class, or you may not need certain career and technical skills. You might need to develop some of the soft skills and the ability to learn. Mm-hmm. Like, say for yourself, I'm just guessing, but I bet you use relatively little of the actual classroom learning you got out of your social work classes. But there's this whole skill set that came with learning it, and then learning how to communicate with all the people in the community and make it. You're mm-hmm. using all of like the soft skills, or Joe Pizzo, a former guest, he called them power skills. And so that's now a term that we throw around on the show. But like you're basically making a career out of soft skills and power skills that you probably learned in the classroom, but like that was never on a standardized test. There's no SOL for any of those things, right? And so when we say like career ready, mm-hmm. some people go, but what about students, inner motivations, their morality, they're all this. And it's like, it doesn't have to be mutually exclusive. Right. and I think that maybe for some students, making that connection to the career helps them see mm-hmm. a reason why they should develop some of those other talents and those other skills.
I mean, just think of some of what we've been doing in Loudoun regarding our equity work is actually preparing students for some of the work world that they'll be going into, and part of what my job is to be able to connect the two. So, having that experience in student services and Department of Instruction, when I look at a student's journey through LCPS now, it's exciting because it's ending somewhat in LCPS, where some of these businesses and companies are taking off. They have now these employee groups. Let's see, I forget the new acronym they're using. I think it's EGC, but they just call them employee groups. And you're seeing them more and more on people's email signatures, right? And so example of this would be these soft skills that you're talking about. So if students are using our social emotional curriculum starting in elementary school, and they're starting to develop these skills, whether it's a morning meeting where you're discussing something, or you're having essentially like a conflict circle where you're working through a problem or an issue. And those skills can be reinforced in some of our deeper learning and project-based learning, where students are still communicating, collaborating, and using some of these same skills. And then, you get to middle school or high school level, and you're getting a little bit more into the affinity group piece, and you have your equity leads, and you're working on some more discussions and more of a deeper dive into race, perhaps, and racial equity. And then you go to some of these companies, Dominion Energy, Equinix data centers, data infrastructure, and when you look at their employee orientations, they are distinctly saying, hey, we've got these affinity groups. And so you may have an LCPS grad who's walked through this journey throughout their LCPS career, and they're comfortable with it, or they've been a part of it already. And they're like, yeah, I'm going to join the Asian Pacific Islander affinity group. And that's going to be pretty cool. And you know what? I might even lead it. And so if you're that's the sort of connection that I think that, I'm excited about more people maybe understanding and appreciating, because that's, I guess that's an example of some of those connections to the real world, quote unquote, that we're starting to have. And I can only imagine that this is going to continue in this trajectory, where we would have students and who knows, maybe some companies would find that they're having to spend less money on some training in these categories, the more our students are entering the workforce with these skills already. So those are just some, that's an example that came up when we were.
Yeah, it's great. And just, I mean, not to, I don't need you to walk me through the daily schedule or whatever, but you sort of talked about the broad idea of what your ideal school is delivering to the students. How would, like, if you were given a school to run, mm-hmm. You get your own, almost think like private school, like there's essentially no legal obligations here. The kids have to learn something and they can't get hurt, but you can do whatever you want with them. Like, would in that ideal situation, would you still be running school like we do, like in the normal buildings with the bell schedule, with your different, disciplines and subject areas? Or as you're thinking more about the project-based stuff, you're thinking more about social emotional learning, you're thinking about these sort of collaborative and cooperative efforts, both between students and between the classroom and the community. Like, how would the school actually look or function differently than what we do now? Or can we actually, like, I know we can do this in the school now, but how different in your mind should school be if we really went all in on that mission?
It would definitely be, different. I can't help but think of kind of the overall, the structure, the physical structure of school. I mean, that we're starting to move away from those, your classic classroom look, but we've got to have more spaces for people to be able to spread out, do their own thing, work on some things independently, but just more collaborative settings. Whether it's the round table piece, when I think about, the ideal school, I can't help but think of the experiential education piece. Even sort of the outdoor education components that I've experienced, and how the natural consequences that would go kind of part of that, but also in peer education, some of these things I mentioned about kind of morning circle, conflict circles, getting into circles and spaces that you can have discussions and but also build community. But that also reinforces sort of the rules. So taking out some of this, the archaic part of the discipline nature of schools, in that the social emotional learning is essentially teaching the community itself to, for lack of a better term, sort of police or manage one another through peer education and peer positive peer education and influence. And so that's definitely something that speaks to me. Another area that I know that's important to you is looking into those kind of career readiness skills, and one of them being public speaking. That has to be an area where I know we're trying to move in that way of, you need to present a project, you need to present a product to someone. But that has to be embedded so early on. And that goes right along with the career exploration piece. I mean, when you look at the VDOE counseling standards for how career development and education is supposed to go, they've got some great stuff. I mean, that some of our elementary school students really could be diving more into just learning a little bit more about what's out there. And I mean, it sounds kind of funny, but that's really something that I thought of is how can we embed more of that experiential education, but have that career component so that some students can see extremely early on, hey, this is someone who's doing something that might be of interest to you. And then as you get older and you move through some of the progression of career readiness, to have embedded things that we've already kind of touched on, internships, apprenticeships, things like that, that right now take away from those, you know, that magic number that we need for those credits that you need to get, right? Yeah. But taking that out and saying, how can you still make up for that in other ways, but get that experience. And it's kind of, Job Corps is a great example. I mean, putting that into an earlier format with an opportunity for many kids to be able to do Job Corps. And it goes back to the fact that, you know, Ryan, I was just reading, this came out a couple of days ago, that this year's freshman class of U.S. colleges, 60% are women and 40% are men. And that number has been getting, you know, climbing, that bridge and divide has been growing for a while. So we've got some things we have to address there.
Yeah.
And even at LCPS, you know, you have 14% of students are not doing a 2 or 4 year school. They might be doing military or something else or trades, but I'm really invested in making sure those students have some serious options as well, that they're going into the workforce to get trained in something that's maybe not customer service right off the bat. That's a trade that they can either move up and advance in their own career or do something different later on. Or maybe if they choose to do higher education a little bit later, they've got a skill set to work on.
Yeah, no, and that's, I think, really important too, is thinking about all those different, you know, there's a lot of different ways to get a good outcome, but we have to actually embrace the idea that some of those other outcomes or options are good, you know? And so mm-hmm. I think, you know, I talk to a lot of people who say, we need more vo-tech stuff. We need more kids going to trade schools. And then I say, what about your kids? And they're like, well, you know, and so there's this thing like, you know, it's a good idea, but then people get, you know, a little cautious or concerned when that applies to their own students. But yeah, you know, I think you point out something really important, you know, when you said that magic number of credits. You know, we also have to think about like that magic number of GPA for the kids who want to go to college. You know, how many AP classes can you take? Well, you know, I'd love to do this internship, or I could get early release and go get a job in a field I'm actually interested in and do whatever. But that means I take two fewer AP classes and that's going to hurt my college. And, you know, and so some of this is really being steered by higher education. Some of this is a matter of local and more often state bureaucracy and sort of these requirements. Yeah. And it doesn't mean that getting rid of all the requirements is the right answer, but we may need to update some of those standards. We may need to update some of those goals, because I think we're seeing that, you know, with access to the internet, and now that we've realized there's so much we can do online, in terms of just meeting with other people and having these oh, yeah. you know, these connections, that maybe, you know, the standards that we've set and we've hung on to for 20 years, and really most of them for a lot longer than that, you know, maybe that needs a little updating. And honestly, I think it's just you trim them down, right? You know, you remove some of the formal structure, and that allows for a little of the additional creativity, where individual school systems can maybe put in place plans that work for their students and their local community. Like, it's hard to legislate something like that at a state level when you think about all the different kinds of communities in a whole state, you know? I think that's part of the reason that all this feels like kind of an uphill battle, because even when you find that you have local support, there's someone in the local schools or local government, their job is to report to the state. And they're like, hold on. Like, right. Everyone says it's great, but hold on. Like, we don't want to pay for all the lawyers it's going to take to make this happen, you know? And so that, you know, you really can run into some red tape that limits this. But it doesn't necessarily mean that we shouldn't try. But you know, I mean, whether it is the GPA or the classes for college or the credit hours or the standardized tests or whatever, none of those things on their own are necessarily bad, but when they all work together, you have essentially handcuffed local school systems in ways that make them less flexible and adaptable to the community that they're really trying to serve.
Right.
And so I think that you know, I don't know the right way to create that flexibility. But I think that that's something that would be important, because then, hey, if you have a local community that they want the traditional, you know, classical school, you can do it. And if you want a place where you're going to do something that's, you know, all in on project-based learning, if the community supports it, you could do it. But right now it's really hard to make that happen because of the sort of the broader structure of education, the way we deliver it. So, all right. So we're going to get ready to wrap this thing up here shortly. I end all of these with two questions. By the way, I'm going to pick your brain about some of this later. You'll get an email from me about some of this in the near future. Okay. But just, you know, for the purposes of concluding a reasonably length conversation, I always offer a little free mic. So if there's anything that you think is important to say that we didn't get to, or maybe I sort of, you know, steered us away from where you were heading or something, is there anything that you want to add or clear up before we do the just for fun recommendations and end this? But yeah, is there anything that you feel like you want to put out there that maybe we didn't do justice to beforehand?
Let's see. I was just thinking, just trying to check in my own notes here. Really just another example of like, of sort of what we're just touching on, sort of this disconnect sometimes between, you know, what we're doing in K-12 education versus what higher education is doing. And I guess I just want to share that I definitely see that. And I know that a lot of that you said it well, an uphill battle. Because of the, you know, I think we've got like some brilliant ideas that are going on in the K-12 world that this established higher education field, some of them are kind of rather maybe can kind of look down on some of this and think like, you know, even if you just want to take, for example, the deeper learning or project-based learning approach versus the lecture approach. Like I saw someone today, some educator just said like, look, if you're still lecturing 45 to 50 minutes to students, like, forget it. That's not, you know, that time is done. They are checked out. They're getting about 20 minutes of that. You've got to do it another way, but you're still, I think we're still running into some old school methods of higher education where that's what someone, that could possibly be a tenured professor's only take on it when you see them. And so that I could see there being a huge disconnect, and that could be probably one of the reasons why maybe we're struggling a little bit with students following through on some things or continuing to develop that love of learning if they get to college and it's a whole new ball game.
you've never sat through an hour lecture and then you go to college, like good luck, you know. And it's a while ago now, it's probably seven or 8 years or more, but we got rid of midterm and final exams. I have students who I teach in AP classes, so they prep for their AP exams. But those kids don't worry about their SOLs because, hey, I'm in the AP class, whatever. And so they don't have like these big cumulative tests that they have to study for in the same way. Like even an AP exam, you prep different than a regular, you know, cumulative semester end exam. And I have so many kids who like contact me freshman year of college and like, so I just had to learn how to study because we never did that. And I'm like, well, on one hand, it was good you didn't have to do some of that. On the other hand, we may have done you a disservice by entirely removing it. Because if one of our goals is to send many, you know, maybe not all, but many of you to college, maybe we should have kept a little bit of that, right? Just even if we think it's regressive in certain ways, if in the end, one of the goals is send them to college and let them be successful there, then we got to provide you the preparation for it. And saying that, you know, you can't sit through an hour long lecture, you know, you shouldn't do it every day. Honestly, hey, I don't lecture every day, but I do once in a while, you know, when kids go like, do we really have to do it? I'm like, look, you ever watch stand-up comedian? I'm like, uh-huh. And I'm like, an hour-long special? And they go, yeah. And I go, you see anybody who just gets bored and walks out? And they're like, no. I go, so the question isn't, can you sit through a lecture? It's, can the lecture do well, the lecturer do well enough to engage you? Mm-hmm. You know, but that being said, you're right. We do get hemmed in to some of these things where, oh, well, that's how it is in college. So we have to do it and we shouldn't feel that way. Or we do the reverse. Hey, we're going to do this cool new thing. But then our students feel like less prepared than we might want, you know?
Right.
I don't know the right balance. I mean, I don't know. Have you heard of the X Labs at JMU? They do.
I have a little bit, but I may need a refresher.
Yeah, I don't know a whole lot. I just, you know, I do a lot of tutoring. I help kids with college, you know, admissions essays and picking schools and mm-hmm. things like that. And a couple of years ago, I was helping a student. It was probably 2 years ago. And they now run something called X Labs, which I think is through like the ISAT, the Applied Sciences and stuff, mm-hmm. Where students basically just get like lab time, and you have like a faculty mentor, and you can work on a team, and they just give you a workspace and tools and do whatever. And if you need funding or you need whatever, like you reach out in the community and they make this community connection. And I'm not sure I'm getting all this 100% right, but it's very much like if you would think of like the college level extension of some of the project-based learning we're talking about mm-hmm. in K-12, it's there. But we also have to remember that just as quick as a kid in the ISAT program might be able to do that, there is a kid sitting in a philosophy class with a 90-minute lecture, you know? And so I don't know that we want to go all in one or the other, but
right.
I think those opportunities are growing. Mm-hmm. The question is who's leading it. And
right.
unfortunately, I don't know that the K-12 schools are the leaders in this. I think a lot of times we're following either what
right.
universities do or what the state says to do. And that sometimes makes it hard to really, really lock in on a program you feel good about. But yeah, mm-hmm. X Labs is cool. That's actually, that's on my list of future guests. I'm trying to nice. Figure out who's the right person to ask in the program, because I would love to hear more about that one. But yeah, that's the kind of application. I just don't know if there's enough of it for us, for everybody to go all in on project-based in K-12 yet.
Yeah. And back to your point, I think there needs to be a balance, because, you know, some of the things that made me want to learn more and really pushed me to develop a love of learning for myself were some of some of your traditional courses or your classics, so to speak, you know, your English courses, my history courses in high school that really pushed me to learn for myself and not for my parents. Those weren't project-based classes. Definitely not how they were taught in my high school.
Right,
lecture based, or writing, very very writing intensive. But those did it for me. So there needs to be something for everybody.
Yeah, it's not easy to do, but you know, if we're gonna set goals, we might as well set lofty ones.
Yes.
You know, and you figure out how you can serve all the kids in that community. All right, so we got lots of good stuff here, but as we work to the conclusion, as you know, I normally ask everybody for a couple of books, a couple of movies, some of one or the other, both. It can be serious educational stuff. It could be, you know, your favorite, you know, Chris Farley movies. It's literally anything that you enjoy. It's sort of a personality piece. Anything you enjoy that you think listeners might enjoy or should probably check out.
Yeah, one book that if I had to, and kind of this goes back to maybe the JMU connection has made me think about this a little bit more, but I took a course at JMU that has stayed with me, and some of the reading stayed with me. It was a survey of African American literature. And so they have this is very much a college textbook, but one of the few that I've held on to is the Norton, you know, survey of or anthology of African American literature. And the fact that I had gone through my primary schooling essentially in what would be called the Deep South of the United States and had so little knowledge of this genre of literature in general and how expansive and dynamic it was within that kind of literary canon, right, of African American history was extremely eye-opening to me and kind of ironic that I would experience that in Harrisonburg, Virginia, and not in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, or South Texas. But that, you know, so that is probably one of the nerdiest books, you know, recommendations you've probably gotten on the
podcast. Okay. I love it. I never got rid of any of those books. I'm now teaching online. And so I had to bring home like almost 20 boxes of stuff. I'm glad I have the green screen rocking, because I've got like boxes and some of them are nothing but the big anthology. So you're saying that I'm like, I think I have that. I'm going to go dig around. I don't know. Yeah. And I love it. That's my level of nerdiness. I'm in.
The only other one I would say is I know this gets thrown out a lot, maybe by your guests, but Brené Brown is, I know she's pretty popular right now. If I had one regret of graduate school is that I did not take a class by Brené Brown. I went to the University of Houston for social work. I think I just missed her, or I think she wasn't quite Brené as she is now
Right.
when I had her or when I was in school there. But the whole kind of foundation of her quote about the man in the arena and only allowing yourself to really be judged by people who are really in it and with it and with you and have been in the trenches, and only really taking their feedback to heart and then really just saying to the people in the crowd that are just there to boo or criticize or take you down, that kind of dismissing that whole her books, how they tell that story in many different ways is I found pretty powerful as far as leadership and professional, but also I've taken a lot of that personally for my own development too.
Nice. Yeah, that's one I have not read anything by her, but I have, I mean, thanks to social media, honestly, I keep in decent contact with a lot of former students. And I always think like I'm now friends on like Facebook and Instagram with like some of my former teachers, which is really kind of cool. But I think just the generation before that, like that connection isn't there. Students graduate, you might know a couple of them. But I've had a couple of students who are in college classes have asked me to like interview for a project they're doing. And no joke, three kids at three different schools have asked me to like be a one of the people they interview. And the part of the theme of either the project as it was assigned or the work they're doing is based on something by Brené Brown. And they're like, so you've read this, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, actually I haven't. So if you could just give me like a little background so I know what I'm talking about. Like, but it's really interesting. So it's definitely a name I'm familiar with, but I haven't read any of the work. And so maybe I will. Do you have a favorite of hers? Like, I know she's got a couple of books out. I don't want to put you on the spot. I'm just saying, like, if I were going to add one to my reading list, do you have one that's your favorite?
I really liked her. I believe it's Dare to Lead.
Okay.
I think that was right, but it gave me some important perspective into how she's dealt with the working world culture, and CEOs and some larger than life type people who you really start to, she has a way of being able to describe and talk about them and work with them in a way that's like reminds you, they're kind of like me, like deep down when you take
Yeah.
everything else away and you strip down to the kind of the bare essentials and the insecurities that even those people who look kind of invincible do have, and how did they get through some of that to do what they do.
Yeah. That's cool. Awesome. So we got a recommendation for a Norton anthology, which is makes my heart warm, and Brené Brown, which I will check out. All right. Well, Grant, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk. If anyone is listening who's interested in getting in touch with you, either with questions or maybe hint, hint, hint listeners, want to volunteer and get involved in some way, what would be a way to get in touch? Do you have like social media handle or an email address, or is there what's a good way for people to find out more or get in touch with you?
Yeah, so on social media, my kind of two of my colleagues and I have formed LCPS Partner. So at LCPS Partner is our Twitter handle. And from there, you can kind of get to career and technical education. You can get to me, and you can get to computer science experiential learning that way. So that's a good start. And then, we could start there. I think that's good. I don't know,
Cool. Yeah.
Ryan, if they do email addresses on here, that might be a little too much. But that's always a way that you can,
Yeah. That's
maybe
perfect.
start that way.
Yeah. That, it's just as a way for anyone who's interested to reach out. And, this is the kind of episode, like sometimes I record stuff and I share it, in places online that are distant. And this is one that I think, is absolutely going to get going to get pumped up in some of the local, you know, local groups and channels, both because I think that's where the interest is, but that's also hopefully where, you know, we get some listeners who are interested in what you're working on and will hopefully, you know, volunteer, get involved. So always just want to give people an outlet there. So, all right, well, this has been the ClassCast podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Tibbins. We've been speaking with Grant Schaefer, the Supervisor of Community Connections for Loudoun County Public Schools, talking all about project-based learning and how to integrate community sort of experiences into the classroom. Grant, thank you again for taking the time to talk tonight. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. And thanks, everybody, for listening.
All right, everyone, have a good one.